Hi everyone, welcome to the Real Estate Funds Podcast. Today we have Max Gonzalez, which is founder of Geometric RE. He has an institutional background where he was VP of investments, and he was highly involved in over 400 million in multifamily assets. He has in which he acquired 266 million in core plus product and 168 million of value add. Now he has his own company, Geometric RE, which I'm sure he will talk about later. So welcome to the show, Max.
Thanks, Weston. Good to be here.
For sure. Yeah, so give us a little bit more about your background and how you kind of got in this position.
Sure. I started my career as a broker back in 2002, and it's crazy for me to say that I've been in the industry for over 20 years, which is nuts. But started as a broker, and I was working in the Santa Barbara market. Santa Barbara is I don't want to call it a sleepy town, but it's not one of the major metros within California. And I was working in multifamily brokerage. I had a senior broker that was on his team. And that senior broker was a guy named Steve Golis, fantastic broker. If you're in Santa Barbara, he's a great guy to know and get do deals with in general, whether you're a buyer or a seller. And I was really able to cut my teeth working with him and get a lot of experience in a really short period of time because he was just killing it. So I was, really young in my brokerage career, doing deals for him. And that was really where I started, but I wanted to get into larger deals. In Santa Barbara, a large deal, might have been 30 units, kind of a thing. That's just not a market that has a lot of, large transactions. And we had some acquisitions guys who used to come into our office looking for deals. And at that point in my career, I really didn't have a very good understanding of what a capital stack looked like, where the money really came from, especially for institutional capital. The deals that we worked on were really all mom and pop. And by mom and pop, we'd request, T12 in a rent roll, and we might get, a handwritten ledger of what the tenant just paid last. It's not really anything. It's a true rent roll. And we would get, receipts for doorknobs kind of a thing. That was often the kind of information that was given to us. And we would, have to work with the sellers in regards to the way they operate their assets. The institutional side, the larger deals, that you see that are really what I'll kind of describe as, the sexy assets. The majority of those deals are owned in some kind of larger capacity with a larger investor pool, or potentially even a larger single payer of the equity stack, despite the fact that equity stack might be made up of several different individual savings accounts or individuals who are invested within the larger fund. And the institutional business, at that point in my career, when I left brokerage, I went to work for a company called Fowler Property Acquisitions. And Fowler was, really collecting a lot more retail investors to do value add deals. And Greg Fowler is the CEO and chairman of that organization, total genius of a guy. And I was really lucky to work with him because, again, it was a shop where I had a lot of really experienced people that I was working with who had been around just a lot longer than me. And, people kind of say, oh, you don't need to be, a genius to do real estate in general. And I agree with that. But the longer 10 years of experience of guys you're working with, the better, because they've seen more, they understand more of the pitfalls. And, and to an outsider's perspective, a lot of people just see deals and they go, oh, that's a piece of real estate. And, that's it. There's not really a very good understanding of, what a return of is should be allocated for a risk-adjusted basis on the quality of the asset. And the longer you're in real estate, the better you get a sense of what that really looks like. And then I worked for Fowler for multiple years before the recession, and then got laid off. The entire acquisitions department got laid off. I think I did the last deal for them in 2009. I don't think they did another deal till 2012 or 13. And during that period of time in the market, most organizations really battened down the hatches during, 2010, 11, 12. Market didn't really start getting into recovery until 13, 14. And before that time, and in those in between years, it was just dead, just totally dead. And then more recently, as you gave me the intro on, worked for an organization called Pacific Urban Residential. And they had a very, very good pedigree of the way that they trained the acquisitions guys in regards to tracking numbers within the market in general. And within all these different organizations, what you really learn is that investments have, or we'll go back into the question regarding institutional funds. But most large sources of institutional funds, whether it's a pension fund or a life insurance company or some major deployer of capital in the market, use a Harvard endowment kind of a thing. You know, these groups have, if you just want to say, you know, $100 or $500 billion worth of assets. And if you zoom that in, you would really see that they're allocated out 50% stocks, 20% bonds, and 30% alternative investments. But if you were to look into that 30% of alternative investments, it even gets stratified within that. Core assets, core plus assets, value add assets, maybe ground up. And this is only talking about multifamily. I mean, a lot of groups who have, you know, deep pockets, you know, they might have different fund managers for each individual allocation of funds for different markets. Mm-hmm. So you might have, you know, one group that's got a fund manager in Florida, but a different fund manager that works in California or Arizona or Texas or North or South Carolina. And, you know, and they have these stratified returns for whatever asset class is really expected to return. Multifamily is going to have one particular segment, but even within multi, core should be your most stable asset class. And as a result, provide the lowest return that's really in the market. So, you know, the core buildings are brand new. You know, you buy them, they're brand new. They came out of the ground within the last, I'll call it 10 years or younger. And everything's new. Roof is new. Electrical systems are new. The plumbing is new. The appliances are new. The designs are new. All of the amenities within the property are new. They're not competing with other very, you know, other new buildings. You know, for those first 10 years, you know, the asset has, you know, what's considered to be low disruption. Meaning you buy it, it's turnkey. You're not really going to expect to have big turn costs. You're not expect to have big repairs and maintenance costs. You have operating costs. You maybe have some lease up costs if you buy it, you know, brand new. But generally, within the operations of an asset, you're buying something that shouldn't really have much stuff that's breaking. And then, you know, once a building reaches 10 years, it usually starts qualifying for more of a core plus categorization. Core plus generally means you're going to have some stuff you're going to have to do, not a lot. You know, a building that's, you know, 10 to 20 years old, still a relatively young building. But if you just say a building is 20 years old, at 20 years, the appliances are going to be replaced. It's just going to happen. You know, at that point in time, the appliances are that old. 20-year-old building is also going to be, you know, 20 years of newer buildings that are now competing for the highest rents. It's going to have designs that are 20 years old. You're going to have, you know, a roof that maybe will have to be replaced within the next couple of years, repaired maybe. You're going to have an elevator that's going to have to be serviced. There's going to be new requirements that you're going to have to do to the building to just get it to be at that new core level if you want to return to that level if you wanted to. And generally, after it's a core plus asset, you know, there's a recognition of a discount to whatever the highest rents in the market are. And that discount has a dollar amount attached to it. So if we're talking about, hey, core building has rents that are here and your value add building has rents that are here. Well, what is this? What is this gap in the rents from the highest in the market to whatever the building you're looking at? And what work has to be done to raise this number up to the top level? And that move is going to be based in whatever cost you're going to attach to it. Most likely you can't get it to the top, you know, level. You know, you're going to be at a discount to the newer buildings. You know, some buildings, the 1970s building, and you go, hey, we're going to renovate this building. And there's some building built in, you know, 2019, that's, you know, right down the street. And you go, were you ever really going to be competing for the 2019 building rents? The answer is probably not. You know, generally when you get a building that's that, has a that big of a gap in age, you know, you can renovate it, you can do a bunch of stuff to improve the rents and the operation of the assets, but there's going to be some things that you're just not going to be able to change. And when you've been in the business long enough, you start being able to just walk into a building and you could tell what age it was built without asking, at least within a couple of years. But 1980s, late 80s was when things started getting a lot better. You know, they started doing, you know, walk-in closets. They started adding washers and dryers to all of the units. They started having higher ceilings in the 90s. You know, you can walk into some buildings and, you know, see what year they were built by the thickness of the countertop or what year they were or what material it was. If you've got a granite, you know, countertop, you're either a late 90s or early 2000s. You know, quartz is going to be something you're going to see used a lot more in the late, you know, 8, 9, or 10, into the teens, you know, these years. And then even the thickness of the quartz will tell you, you know, generally how old the asset is. Right now, you know, you see a lot of shaker cabinets, quartz, you know, vinyl flooring, but those materials will change also, you know, within the coming time. But all of these buildings that are out there, depending on how many moving pieces they have, are really going to be the ones that are going to stratify out what the actual returns are supposed to look like for the deal. and the more moving pieces, generally that means that the return should be higher. And I don't mean that you should look at an offering memorandum and say this is a guaranteed number. And that's a big mistake that a lot of people make within the industry, is they look at an offering memorandum and they say, well, this OM says that the IRR is going to be a 17. And, you know, you're going to look at these buildings, but the question that you should also be asked of, you know, the sponsor is, well, what percentage of guarantee would you apply to this 17% IRR? And if they say 100%, they're probably being a bit naive. They might be, you know, hopeful, you know, when you're in the role of the sponsor, you know, you've already done the numbers and you have some expectations of how the asset is going to perform at that level. But the more deals that a sponsor has completed, the better they're going to be able to estimate or guess what that percentage chance of success is, because they'll have done it. You know, you have a sponsor who steps into a new market and they do a renovation on a building, you know, for the first time. It's probably when they're going to really find out some things that they maybe didn't know previously. You get someone who comes into the Phoenix market and they have an expectation of cost for renovation of a unit. They might be right. Might also be the first one they've done in Phoenix. They might find out that certain city code things they had to get done weren't done right. Maybe they find out that there are certain construction issues in the building they weren't aware of, versus, you know, a sponsor who maybe has done 10 buildings in one particular area within the last 12 months. Well, that group's probably going to have a much better finger on the pulse of costs and expenses within the market. Now, and I'm not trying to fault any individual person within an offer memorandum of what they're presenting. But my point is that the more moving pieces on a deal, the higher the expected return should be, because there's more pitfall for error on an asset. So when looking over, you know, your core assets to your value add assets, those core assets, they don't have many moving pieces. You're buying something that's already new. You're buying it with long-term debt. You're not even going to have to refinance, and the rents are already topped out on the market. You get somewhere else down the line, core plus deal, a little bit of work to be done, value add deal, heavy value add deal, you know, there's more pitfalls that can occur. And the more pitfalls that occur really are what you are paying for within that high IRR. And there are times in my career where I really pushed, you know, advocacy for, you know, high IRR deals, where now I look at them and I go, you know, I really agree with lower, fewer moving pieces are really a benefit. Because a lot of guys, you'll talk to a lot of guys and they'll say, oh, you know, I only want to see something with 17 IRR. But what that means is they're also, you know, unfortunately filling their portfolio exclusively with assets that have risk. And right now in the market today, we are seeing, unfortunately, a realization of what a lot of that risk really means within a declining market. You know, a rising market when cap rates are compressing, you know, there's a lot of factors that can save, you know, a sponsor and investors on a deal. You know, the cap rates are compressing. Maybe the roof bid came in, you know, at a higher number. Maybe the target rents didn't come in quite as good, but the cap rates keep compressing. Well, that's really going to save a lot of investors on those assets, given those factors. The market goes the other way. Any risk that was associated just gets a huge magnifying glass on it. And that's what a lot of people are seeing right now. They're seeing these assets that are just unfortunately kind of in the red, you know, and people might, you know, and the debt markets particularly are the factors that I get very upset with the Fed for increasing the interest rates as fast as they did. You know, I don't disagree that they needed some increases actually in regards to the velocity of the market for a period of time. But I would argue the speed with which they shot the market up, I think 525 basis points within about 14 months was wildly aggressive, you know, and that's something that everyone is just feeling right now. And most of the assets that I look at in Phoenix, you know, I talk to some of the brokers that are there, and, you know, for an example, in regards to basis point spread and risk, if you're buying a core building, generally, if you're putting long-term debt on it, and the long-term debt is, I'll call it, you know, 5.75. 5.75 is pretty cheap right now. If you can get a deal down to 5.75, which I've heard that some guys can get depending on affordability of the debt and a long amortization, you know, you hopefully you're getting a cap rate that's close to, if not better than that number. So if you're 5.75 on the debt rate, you know, hopefully you're buying the building for, you know, I'll call it a 5.8 cap or something like that. But you got to keep in mind, there's no value add. Core building, you're buying something, it's already topped out. If you think you're going to go in and, you know,
slash payroll or, you know, go into the units and, you know, crank rents. Probably not. Brand new building rents are probably already topped out. Probably not a whole lot you can do. So you're buying something that should have, you know, not much work, but you're not really going to get a really big spread on increasing the NOI at the asset to get to a cap rate that's say 6.5 or 75 to 100 basis points. That's higher than that number. For a value add deal, generally, you want to find a deal where you're going to be able to increase the cap rate to about 100 basis points over the exit cap that you're underwriting to. And that exit cap right now is a very unknown number. So if we're talking about a core building that's out in the market and you go, hey, what should the cap rate on this building be? And you say 6 because you're getting debt at 6 and the cap rate on the building is 6. An often rule of thumb is adding 10 basis points to the exit cap for every year of hold. So if you're saying, hey, cap rates right now, core buildings are 6, and I'm simplifying this analysis. 5-year hold, 6.5 exit. All right. Well, if it's a value add deal, you'd be expected to increase the cap rate up to 100 basis points above that number for margin of security. So you get up to about a 7.5 cap to arbitrage that 100 basis points. And, you know, in that calculation of how guys are creating that spread is something that in today's market is a very, very, it's challenging. You know, a lot of people haven't really quite assessed how much value has been taken out of the market. You know, you hear a lot of guys talk about, oh, well, you know, there's just not a lot of transaction volume, so we don't really know where the cap rates are in the market. No, they know where the cap rates are on the market. And the reason that buildings aren't trading is because the sellers don't want to take the pricing that's being offered by the buyers who have their hands cuffed by the debt available within the market. That's the reality of it. If they did, you would see the cap rates are probably 6.5 today in Phoenix to use a specific market. And
yeah, I like your thought process behind, you know, the more moving pieces in the deal, the more risk, obviously. My show is about, you know, helping limited partners, you know, reduce risk, increase return. If they're investing in a deal that has, you know, more moving pieces, opportunistic value add, how would they reduce risk in that circumstance?
Don't invest in opportunistic value add. I mean, my real answer is invest on assets that, I mean, within a portfolio, you should have, there's something called the Markowitz scale of returns, which pretty much describes this that I was describing by Harvard Endowment, these other groups that stratify out returns. And what that says is that if you have some assets in your portfolio that are A class holds that have low return, you know, B class holds that have a little bit of a higher return, and C class holds that are a higher risk and a higher return, that you'll do better on the average of all of them versus had you put all your eggs into the super secure A class and super risky C class. You know, the C class assets, the 79 IRRs, you know, there's a reason junk bonds are priced at the level that junk bonds are priced. And I don't want to call real estate a junk bond, but that analogy kind of works in regards to explaining where risk is really associated and why returns are at that level. So, you know, being in first position for a lot of people who put out money as debt turned out to be a really great investment for a lot of people. You know, if you look and pricing but, you know, returns are also very spot in time, you know, and there's an analogy that Warren Buffett has where he says, hey, if you bought an asset, if you bought a car and it was $80,000 and the following day someone offered you 50, would you be upset and thinking the car's value is 50K? Or would you be like, well, hey, no, I bought the car for 80K and I was going to use it for many years and it's the same car it was before. It doesn't matter what someone offered me for that car. That analogy doesn't directly correlate over to real estate, but our current pricing in the market right now is highly, highly, highly correlated to the interest rates that we have that are available, which might be here for a while. In fact, for multiple years. The inflation story is also very, very real. And looking at how much the money supply has grown during the last two presidencies is an absolutely insane number. If you actually look at how much money's been printed both by Trump and by Biden during the last 8 years, it is a truly staggering amount of new money added to the money supply. And for a lot of the people who bought assets in 21 and 22, you know, if they hadn't raised interest rates to the level they did, the pricing would have kept going up.
And if they drop interest rates again, a lot of that recognition of money supply is in supply will probably be recognized again. So back to your question in regards to, you know, how do LP investors mitigate risk on opportunistic deals? The biggest thing that I would recommend is making sure that the in-place cap rate that someone's buying on the deal covers the debt on the asset. That would be the biggest one. And I would also argue that putting any kind of bridge financing on any deal, no matter what it is a mistake. That's really what I would argue. If you're a sponsor and you're saying, hey, I'm going to buy this deal and I'm going to, you know, put bridge on at 10% and, you know, renovate it in 2 years and then get these target rents, and those target rents are, you know, kind of a maybe. You know, we don't know. Country slips into recession. That's another point of risk that is somewhat. It's another moving piece. It's another moving piece that someone can't quite assess. So, you know, if you're putting on a long-term debt, what I would recommend is long-term debt, under leverage the deal, get your value add done, and then refinance it after. You know, and that's it. But explain that to the investors that you're intentionally putting them into an asset that has initial years of low cash flow, that you're trading for those initial years for security in the deal. And then you can refinance in a long-term debt after 2 years. There's debt options that you can get for long-term debt that will allow, you know, a supplemental or someone to do a cash out refinance after, you know, the assets reached a new level of return, or potentially even having a particular body of investors that are a pref piece. And their investment within a pref piece covers the cost of the renovation for the asset, and you bring in their dollars as some kind of a debt instrument if you wanted to do that. But that would put you into better position than, you know, owing money to a lender who a lot of guys right now in the market are very much beholden to. There's a lot of deals out there right now where, you know, guys are trying to figure out how to cover, you know, the increased cost of debt in the market.
Sure. Yeah, tell us some more about how your institutional experience helped you start your new company, Geometric Real Estate, and how, like, what types of deals are you guys doing?
You know, I'm not really sure how much it has, to be really honest. You know, it's been fantastic in regards to, you know, understanding how a lot of money flows within the market. But we started our organization during a very difficult time, and we knew it was. We knew pricing was very, very inflated. And, you know, and we still wanted to go out and, you know, wanted to be in the market, but we also recognized that we really wanted to be patient with in growth of our assets. And right now we're really doing a lot of waiting in regards to figuring out where the floor is. And the groups that hold the debt in the market, I'm sorry, not the groups hold the debt, but the assets that are being sold by banks right now are really the groups that are setting the market. And some of those groups haven't really recognized, you know, what's on their books. You know, they bought an asset. They put debt on an asset. The sponsor is no longer in position. The asset's now gone back to the bank, and the banks still haven't quite accepted where the pricing is in regards to the market. And, you know, and that factor is something that we're going to have to work through for probably another 24 months, to be honest. That's really probably how long it's going to take to work through a lot of this stuff. I'd love to say it's going to be 12, but these things take a long time. And in regards to just previous experience, how it's helped right now, I think the best thing is, you know, the analytics experience. You know, that experience of understanding how capital is placed is very important. But I'll comment, you know, most institutions, you know, they want to deploy capital with sponsors who have a long tenure and a long track record of performance. Like, if you're going out and you want to present to, you know, major sources of equity that have fund managers in many different markets, and it's the Harvard Endowment or it's some major pension fund that places capital, you know, they are very, very shrewd with who they decide to allocate capital to place on their behalf. It's not generally the kind of thing where you can, you know, find a deal and then call up, you know, a pension fund and say, hey, do you want to throw capital into the deal? And I'll also argue that for the institutional capital, those are also the groups who are the large check writers who are very, very skilled at writing deals within their favor. So if a deal doesn't go as well as expected, or they want to, you know, force something down on the sponsor, they have the power to do that. They are the main owner of the deal, and they can do so. Retail investors, if you're able to instead raise $10 million from retail investors to go do a deal, it's probably going to be a better
business model for the actual sponsor than just going to one single individual check writer who's an institutional holder. But if you have those contacts and you have one person you can call to, you know, to fund your asset, then, you know, that makes the capital raising job significantly easier. Fantastically so, you know, because then you don't have to do a bunch of capital raising. You have one group who can fund your deals.
Sure. Yeah. Talk about your guys', you know, early track record, because you started in 2021.
Our track record's then, you know, I'm just saying, I mean, we've been trying to be very selective with what deals we want to work on. And this year, and really most of last year also, we've been almost exclusively doing capital raising work. That's it. You know, we are looking for investors that want to be part of the next wave of buying, which is really going to start after the bottom of this trough that we're in. And then there'll be another cycle that will start again. Last cycle, 2014, ran all the way up to present. And that's really what's going to be the future from now moving forward. Not now, but I want to say sometime in the next 18 months moving forward from that.
Gotcha. Yeah. So you guys are being pretty patient and just waiting for the market to correct.
That's correct. We have an asset in, I don't know if I'd flat out say we're just waiting for the market to correct, but the deals that we're offering on, and this is the reason the deals just aren't selling right now, is because buyers are making offers and the sellers are just saying, hey, we just can't sell it for that, or it's not the right number, or, you know, that doesn't cover our debt value, or, you know, there's a reason that the transactions aren't actually occurring. And that's something that just has to be, takes time to work through. And for us, we've got an asset in California. We've got a couple of short-term rentals in Indio here in California. We have three assets in the Phoenix market. The last one we bought was a 13 unit in Papago, in Phoenix. And that one was a great buy. We bought it at a in place 5.5 cap. It had a 4.4% in place debt on it, fixed until 2029. And it had some rent spread in there that we've actually not really tried to attach. We've tried to just make sure that we're just signing renewals with every tenant at that asset. And that was last deal we did, which was in November of last year. And then this year, we've underwritten deals. We've been looking at them. Majority of the time spent, you know, networking and looking for guys who want to deploy capital, you know, for the next cycle. That's really what we've been focused on.
Gotcha. Yeah. So how do you find your investors for deals? Is it just primarily retail investors?
Yeah. Yeah. That's accurate.
For
and,
sure.
You know, and the answer to that is grinding, to be really honest.
Yeah, just keep going in person, because that's where I've seen more success, is being in person, you know, face-to-face relationships where you can build trust with people. So yeah, talk about, you know, how your deals are going, you know, that you've purchased previously. You're kind of holding through this higher interest rate market. What are you seeing with those?
We're all in a waiting phase. You know, we have one asset in Phoenix right now that we would sell, but we're in no pressure to do it. The rents are fine, debt's fine, everything on it is fine, but the market kind of fell out of the floor. So we're just going to be waiting to, you know, sell that deal when we do. But we do have a very, I do have a very optimistic forward view on values of real estate in regards to the inflation story. You know, we do not have a fire sale need on anything, despite the fact that, you know, we would, the one asset that I'm mentioning, we would love to move it just to free up capital. That's it. We would love to move just to free up capital, but we don't have any pressure to do so. And we just pulled that listing, that was on the market for the past couple of months, and the asset's working fine for us, and we'll just keep owning it, and then we'll sell it, you know, when the market returns.
For sure. Yeah. So how does your firm differentiate from other firms that might be doing a similar business plan, similar markets? How do you guys elevate the game in terms of what you're doing?
Gosh, Weston, I wish I could tell you something that was really different. You know, the real estate industry, especially for multifamily, has gotten very homogenous. It really has. And, you know, and what I would say with me is, you know, direct honesty. You know, we're really shrewd with numbers. And, you know, and I really tell people, if I talk to an investor and they go, we only want to invest in 17 IRRs, I generally tell them, you're going to get bit. Don't do that. And if you're forcing all your money into these high risk assets, you're going to have something that's going to cause, you know, a decrease in returns for you at some point. And if you can do a steady eddy, a lot of groups, you know, they just want a solid 8% on their money per year versus a 17. If you do a solid 8 and don't have any losses ever, you probably do well, better than the groups that are only investing in the high teens IRRs, to be honest. That's really the reality of it. And I really advocate now more than I have ever before, seeing what we're going through now, invest in the sexiest properties you can. You know, the long-term game, a lot of people have this, you know, greed factor where they look at those OMs and they make the assumption that those numbers are somehow, you know, truly going to work out like that. But I'll tell you right now, I mean, you go back, you know, 3 years from now, no one would have thought the Fed would have cranked rates as high as they did. You know, no one, you know, when we, for our deals, everyone's deals, you know, generally there's calculations that are done for calculating out, you know, what it looks like for, you know, cap rate expansion, cap rate compression, you know, what will the deal perform if we sell it at a 4 cap, or what do it look like if we sell it for a 5.5 cap? In Phoenix, if you had said to any broker in 2021 or 2022, hey, I'm using a 5.5 exit cap for this deal, they would have laughed at you and they would have hung up the phone and said, I'm never going to do a deal with this guy because he's just so off. Because for all of 21, these guys were just getting call after call after call, with people throwing money at them, trying to get money into the market. And if rates dropped again, on a side note, with as much money as on the sidelines, that would probably happen again. It really probably would. You know, we're at a very, I'll call it, point in time where a lot of people are handcuffed as a result of these higher interest rates. But these higher interest rates are here to stay for some time. They are. And the market's going to have to correct and adjust for that. But, you know, the rent growth in the market, the increase of money and supply, those factors are going to come back to real estate. It is very likely that in 2030, we'll be paying $20 for a cup of coffee. Really?
Wow. Yeah. A couple of quick questions to wrap up the show. What is the number one thing LP investors should look for when they're investing?
Long-term experience, I would say. You know, you're investing with a person. That's what I would look at.
For sure. You think, you know, the more experience, the more deal flow, obviously, the, you know, the better they can look at the investment as a whole.
I mean, I would, you know, the individual and the team, you know, there's a lot of, back to that kind of comment about how there are a lot of factors within, you know, I'll call it a acceptance of risk within a market where prices are increasing, where, you know, that risk didn't make a difference. You know, and large acquisitions, you know, when you're buying a deal, there's a lot of people involved, a lot more people than you think. You know, you might look at a deal and go, oh, that guy bought that deal, but who's on his team? How good is his construction team? How good is his asset management team? How good is the property management team? You know, how good, you know, are the debt guys that are working on the deal? You know, there's a lot to really go into the whole team. And that's why when I say, like, you know, look at who you're investing with, you know, the person, but the general company, return, you know, not return, but company, group of people that are working on it. And that's something that I think also comes into institutional placement of capital. They're going to look at the whole thing. And I do for a fact know that there are some organizations that require, if they allocate money to a particular sponsor, that they will also require there to be dedicated staff people that exclusively work on their account. So they don't want the staff members split between, oh, they're also working on this value add portfolio in Kentucky. They're exclusively working on their assets that they are allocating money for the growth of their pension.
Gotcha. Yeah, a lot of great takeaways there. How can investors get in contact with you?
You know, our website is just my email, mgonzalez@geometricre.com. Also just our website in general, geometricre.com. At that location, there's a way to email us and get in contact. We also run a podcast, the Real Estate Dads Podcast. And that podcast, if you're a dad and you are in the real estate industry, you've got some great story of overcoming obstacles or how you work through your work-life balance having kids, we want to hear your story. You can get in touch with me through that website also. To be a guest if you are interested in doing so.
Sounds good. Thank you for joining us, Max.
You got it, Weston. Call anytime.